chapter 4, Epistle to the Philippians. Hobnobbing with the Swells. Samuel Phillips ran a gunpowder mill during the American Revolution and took time off during that unpleasantness to found a school for boys from all quarters in 1778. The school charter is quite impressive and includes many admirable ideals, some of which were actually realized. The first class included ages from 6 to 22. In 1807, Calvinists fled Harvard after that august institution appointed a Unitarian, whores, to a professorship of divinity. They founded the Andover Theological Seminary and shared the campus with Phillips Academy. Thus, Andover found itself at the polar opposite of the New England Transcendentalists, such as Emerson, Thoreau, and Alcott, who were leading America to a fresh and original spiritual life. The cold, dead hand of John Calvin still has a lingering, ghostly presence on campus and in our long dark night of the Protestant work ethic. In 1908, the seminary left to its own regressive campus down the road, and the modern era of preppy heaven commenced. It was the age of a small group of extremely wealthy barons of industry and finance controlling everything, riding the wave of the Industrial Revolution. A weak government and a tiny middle class, with most of the population struggling in poverty, was perfect for them to sustain the new aristocracy. The very rich used private education as the prime method for ensuring the continuation of wealth, power, connections, and privilege for the well-born. Enter Thomas Cochrane, alumnus of Andover and Yale, the traditional combination like Exeter and Harvard. He became a partner in J.P. Morgan and Company in 1917. As one of the richest and most powerful men in the country, he could indulge in whatever he liked, and he chose Andover for his indulgence. During the 20s and 30s, old buildings were moved into a new grand landscape, and his campaign of building transformed the school into a remarkable edifice. By the middle of the Depression, Andover was fit for the snottiest of young white Protestant capitalist spawn, complete with secret societies, hazing, and some remarkable and memorable pranks. Yes, scholarship was expected, but those from particularly rich and powerful families could not fail, and their offspring would be guaranteed admission, assuming the dynastic fortunes and alumni contributions continued. One such dynasty was the Bush clan. Prescott Bush could spend a few shekels earned from doing business with Fritz Tyson, among others, to shuffle young George H.W. off to Andover. There he could learn all about sucking up and kicking down. Roosevelt decided Prescott was too rich to prosecute for treason, but you can be sure they sent young George in the direction of Japan, not Germany, just as they did with Lindbergh. FDR was a Groton boy and, bless his sacred memory, a traitor to his class. Grandson George WTF was class of 65, and his brother, what's-his-name, was at Andover when I arrived. Skip, Chip, Jeb, I can't keep them straight. Just my luck. It isn't what you know, it's who you know, and I can't remember names. While Andover existed to fill this dynastic role for the rich, sometimes the dynasties went in liberal and egalitarian directions. William Sloan Coffin Jr. was a classmate of G.H.W. Bush's at both Andover and Yale, and was a member of Skull and Bones. After working with the CIA, he was disillusioned with the powers that be and became an important progressive leader. He was arrested for draft resistance in 1968 with another Andover and Yale alumnus, Dr. Benjamin Spock, who, with his baby book, helped make the social revolution of the 60s possible. Strange things happen when you show affection to babies. Just down the street was Abbott Academy, a girls' school that merged with Andover the year after I graduated. In fact, the 4 years I was at Andover saw the greatest changes in the school's history for any single class. When I arrived, coats and ties were the dress code. Chapel was mandatory twice a week. Each term, a student could miss no more than 3 breakfasts or classes. By the time I was a senior, most of us looked like hippies. Thank you, Jesus. A few statistics. In the early 50s, 1% of the student body was black. All the faculty were white, none Jewish, with 3 staff members who were Catholic. It caused a sensation when one of them was given faculty status. One of the Catholic staff members will always have a warm place in my memory, the unforgettable Bob Leet. Dear old Bob was nearing the end of his career when I arrived. He was in charge of food services in Commons, the large dining hall erected in 1930. He supervised some 10 million meals in his long career. Bob was a chain smoker who disdained the use of ashtrays. I wondered if he put a wire in his cigarettes, as the ash would invariably reach 2 inches or more, leaving us to wonder at its structural integrity as he leaned over the beans. Breakfast was a required meal, and it closed at 8 a.m. Bob would stand at the door, greeting latecomers with a cheerful and sardonic, "It's 8 a.m. Goodbye! It's 8 a.m. Goodbye!" Bob certainly had our health and fitness in mind, having started off as a football coach, and set an example by living across the street from Commons and driving to work every day. One faculty member, impressed by the morning pancakes, folded one up, put it in Bob's shirt pocket, and said, "If you ever have a blowout." He was a model for progressive and enlightened hiring practices, signing on mentally and developmentally challenged people from a local area to work in the kitchen. This came with some understandable complications. One day, I looked closely at my spaghetti and found the wire from someone's retainer. I fished it out and wore it proudly in my lapel for weeks. First Year Follies. I arrived wide-eyed to this enormous expanse of towering elm trees and Episcopalian architecture with its private bird sanctuary, half-million book library with a glass roof, art and archaeology museums, 100-stop organ in a church that could seat 1,000, music building complete with gargoyles. It was all too much. The people here must be happy and content, I thought, and here I can live in peace and tranquility for the next 4 years. The teachers know that they have the best possible jobs, and the students are here only because of dedication to excellence in scholarship and because of proven aptitude and accomplishment. With our every creature need provided for, we could concentrate on our studies and prove worthy of admission to the best universities in creation. Should we become lonely? There was Abbott Academy, a short walk away, as well as dances arranged with some of the most exclusive girls' schools in New England. Impressed by our erudition and sartorial taste, these girls of fine breeding and sophistication would find us fascinating and worthy of admiration and properly restrained affection. Our spiritual needs would be satisfied by the ministrations of our own clergy, who would inspire us with their faultless example and inspiring sermons. In addition to our own theatrical and musical performances, we would have periodic movie screenings of tasteful and interesting cinematic productions. Prominent personages of all stripes would come from time to time to address the assembled student body, engaging us with their wit and wisdom, and preparing us for our prosperous and achievement-filled careers. Well, some of it was true all the time, and all of it was true some of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time. And what was the first sign of something amiss? When I filled out my schedule of classes, I noted that each class lasted 45 minutes, but the time between classes was 7 minutes. What evil genius violated the symmetry of nature in this manner? I had to remember to arrive at 4:23 to an afternoon class. Oh, and then there was hazing. The first 2 weeks, new students were subject to prepping by seniors until we were officially deprepped in a bizarre ceremony. It took weeks to get the Vaseline out of my hair. This was the last year for prepping, and good riddance. But it wasn't anywhere near as bad as what we did to each other. There were two rich jocks in my dorm who were meaner than most, taking advantage of the fact that both the rich and the jocks play by different rules, which amplify when combined. The school wanted to win games, and when they found an applicant who could pay full tuition and score goals, he was in. Who cares about low intelligence or defective character? So these guys could mess with any of the weaker students all they liked, and the folks in charge just thought it was funny. One of these jerks was the scion of an oil fortune, who had the habit of defecating in the manicured bushes. This was not the mad shitter, who was a senior that year. Mysterious baggies of dupe were discovered in students' dresser drawers and desks, leading to a mad shitter hunt of some magnitude. When suspicion centered on the guilty party, he deflected attention by depositing his gift in his own drawer. The other worst offender, and yes, I mean you, Norm Stitzer, along with his oil fortune buddy, had an odd psychosexual deviation that led them to enjoy ripping off the underpants of weaker classmates. To the cheering and laughing onlookers, these violent wedgies were enormous fun and were only humiliating and painful to those who couldn't defend themselves. And who cares about them? In my case, it became so extreme that I was hung on a high coat hook by the back of my belt. The hall proctor, a senior who lived with us and who was supposed to enforce simple decency, took me down, but did nothing else. I wasn't rich. Turning the other cheek was great for the bullies, not so great for me. So by Thanksgiving, I was ready to defend myself. While at home, I took a small knife that I could fit in my pocket. When I got back to school, I told friends of Stitzer to let him know I had a knife and I wasn't afraid to use it. I'd already had years of harassment, and this was going to end, even if I had to cut him. The next time I passed him in the hall, I put my hand in my pocket, and he stayed far away from me. Thankfully, the violence ended right there. Norm flunked out soon after, which in his case took some doing, but you do need to show up to some classes, even if you're a rich jock. In October, I decided to join the Philomathian Society, the debating club, which met in the same room since 1825. It took $2 to join, so I scraped and borrowed and thought I had enough. When I got to Bullfinch Hall, I found I only had $1.99, and no one would lend me the extra cent. Thankfully, the club officers let it slide. When we did our arguments, I noticed that no matter how strenuously I tried to be serious and straightforward, people simply could not take me seriously. My voice and expressions were just inherently goofy. I didn't want to be a damn lawyer anyway, so I quit the club, leaving the others to become master debaters. One night that fall, coming home from a philo meeting, I saw a full moon behind two layers of clouds, each going in different directions. It was so stunningly beautiful that I found myself saying, "There must be a God." Quite surprising for the young materialist. But this made me 5 minutes past the 8 p.m. deadline for being back in the dorm. I was greeted at the sign-in book by Goober, our housemaster, who was one of the three school ministers attending to our spiritual needs. He was enraged and staggering, eye-popping drunk. He grabbed me by the ear and hauled me to the sign-in book with a slobbering and threatening harangue only an alcoholic cleric can deliver. Could I count on the faculty for protection from attack by other students and the clergy for transcendental and moral guidance? Oh, lighten up. Most of the time, though, I managed to enjoy Andover, and the prospect of leaving and going to public school was enough to make me put up with just about anything. Anton was not so fortunate. From time to time, when I was home on vacation, while public school was still in session, I would join him to visit Beverly High School. It was always a shock and a reminder of how lucky I was, Stitzer and all. I read a cartoon a few years ago about how when puberty starts, everyone gets a number stamped on their forehead between 1 and 10. They don't know what it is, but everyone else can see it. People with similar numbers cluster together, and everyone wants to be with those with higher numbers. Lower number people are shunned. Andover and similar schools were lousy with high number cases, and of course, my number was Unitarian. The school organized dances with girls' schools, and that first fall they had a dance with, of all places, Shore Country Day School. This was possible because while boys went up to the 8th grade at Shore, the girls went up to 9th. This was actually a fun night for me, since I could introduce my classmates from both schools. Later dances that year, however, were grim affairs. I never could tolerate the loud, mindless music. Shouting directly into another person's ear might sometimes result in comprehension. While the custom was for a girl to agree to dance with any boy for one dance, even if she didn't much care for him, for some reason I was unable to find any partners. My Andover buddies simply didn't believe me, so I said, "Just watch." I went to a line of a dozen girls and asked each in turn, as nicely as I could, if she would like to dance. Not a slow dance. This was the standard fast dance, where people stood somewhere within a couple of yards of their partner and wiggled this way and that as the spirit moved. Each girl in turn said, "No," generally with the impression that they were somehow insulted by the proposition. I went back to my friends, whose mouths were hanging open in disbelief. I didn't go to another dance for 17 years. My violin teacher was Bill Schneider. He was a veteran of the air war in Europe, with 27 bombing runs over Germany. You could tell he had witnessed real hell. I became good friends with him, and his wife Seji during my Andover years. Very few students in his long career intended to become professional musicians, and I also had no such intention until 1972. But after that, my plans changed to music. Thus, our relationship was rather intense. Unfortunately, Bill had some serious personal problems with mental health and alcohol, and it would have been better for my development as a performer to have taken lessons elsewhere. I found it impossible to cause him that kind of pain and stuck with him for the 4 years. One effect of required chapel attendance on Sundays and Wednesdays was a tremendous performance opportunity for classical musicians. We took full advantage of having the better part of 1,000 audience members, whether they enjoyed it or not. Our organist, Dr. Lorene Bonta, was in a perpetual feud with conductor Schneider and hid herself behind large oak screens while performing. The organ had been a masterpiece in its day when constructed in the Thomas Cochran era, but that was 40 years in the past. Many, if not most, of the 100 stops were wheezing, gasping, or entirely silent. We never were quite sure what might be nesting in the pipes and didn't care to disturb errant wildlife. With such a massive instrument, renovation was a huge and costly project that was delayed until after my graduation. The school's rapid change included the church, and in my second year, chapel became voluntary. At once, our audience dwindled to a loyal dozen souls. My grades fluctuated wildly depending on whether I was interested or not, even in math and science, where I was accustomed to doing very well. The teachers were the best I've ever experienced, with only a few exceptions. The revolution that gave us Ronald Reagan. Our headmaster was John Kemper, an Army historian who took the helm at age 35 in 1947. He was an excellent writer and eloquent speaker, facing some bewildering times for a West Point graduate and lieutenant colonel. In the spring of 1970, campuses around the country went on strike to protest the Vietnam War and the killings of students by the National Guard at Kent State. Of course, the idea of students on strike at a proto-Ivy League school is more than faintly ridiculous. We weren't exactly striking during mealtimes, but we didn't go to class. Take that, Nixon and Westmoreland! If anything gave aid and comfort to the Indochinese enemy, it was our cutting French. Except for the Young Americans for Freedom, which was a kind of rich kids' KKK, we were all heartily sick of the war. I had participated in vigils and marches and was anticipating doing whatever was required to not be drafted. When my brother went in for his physical, he went to the bathroom and fell asleep. A few hours later, they gave him a 4F and he could go home. So there we were on the steps of Samuel Phillips Hall, presumptive heirs to Anglo-Saxon global domination, with the columns before us and the grand vista behind, on strike against the man, which was us in 30 years. I recall a speech by Freddie McClendon, the black senior class president with a major afro, aimed at getting us all pissed off, preaching to the choir. He was followed by John Kemper, who gave a talk actually requiring us to reflect on a complex situation. It was well-reasoned and thoughtful, not what one would necessarily expect from a man who was born and raised in the military and who had no civilian experience except as headmaster. The anger and frustration were diffused. We called it a party and left. Kemper was dealing with other more serious issues. After a lifetime of smoking, he had lung cancer. In 1971, I had a vivid dream of him going through a door into the next world. Shortly afterwards, I learned that he had died a couple of hours before the dream. I played with the school orchestra at his funeral and had a strong feeling of his presence. This strike did not imply most students had sympathy with the counterculture. I had a picture of my brother and me on my wall that year, and people would frequently comment about "that damn hippie" in reaction to his long hair and beard. A cultural shift would have to wait until I was a senior. Now that we weren't protesting anymore, we could have our own miniature war games in the dining hall. Commons was no ordinary cafeteria. Marble staircases, well worn by generations of students, led to the upper two of four large dining areas. The decor included murals of the evolution of mankind as known in 1930, walls of mirrors, oak paneling, chandeliers, and extraordinarily high ceilings on the second floor. The mirrored walls were superb targets for tea bags. We would rip out the middles of slices of bread and toss them up to the chandeliers in hopes of making a ringer. Successful tosses would remain in evidence for months, and even the highest ceilings were targets for the more athletic. In years past, diners had cloth napkins, but now we had paper. Reason was, kids put butter in the middle of the cloth napkins and pulled the ends tight, sending the butter onto the ceiling. There it would remain until the next period, when it would come down onto the next set of diners. I knew one large black fellow from Chicago named Elrod, who was incredibly muscular. When collecting butter from tables, he would casually reach a hand into the butter bucket and with only a wrist flick send a fistful of fat to the ceiling, all the while appearing to continue in his appointed duties. Some grease spots above us were rumored to have been deposited some 10 or more years ago. One day, after a particularly ghastly repast, we started chanting, "Leet, leet, leet, leet." Bob Leet came out, expecting to take a bow for exemplary work, and we pelted him with dinner rolls. Another day, we noticed some panic among the wombats, as we termed the kitchen staff. The silverware had disappeared, and they needed to feed 900 people. Some of our braver lads had hidden the utensils on the roof. And there were legendary food fights. The air would seem to fog with flying victuals. I recall with fondness the tallest member of our first-year class, some 6 feet 4 inches, getting half a grapefruit smack in the nose. Such was life before coeducation. Girls are a civilizing force, although life in the trees wasn't all that bad. That winter, I had spent a lot of time with a fellow student designing a ramjet helicopter. After getting into the gory details, it was obvious that this was far beyond our capabilities, and I switched over in the spring to building a flying model Zeppelin. I started with a trial balsa frame only a couple of feet long, working out design difficulties, and finally decided on a 12.5-foot-long balsa structure with transparent plastic skin and gas bags with radio control. There were some books in the library about dirigibles, and I studied all information that was possible to obtain about them. In years past, the tradition was to perform a Gilbert and Sullivan operetta every year, but that had changed to Broadway musicals. I was needed in the pit, although it was a big commitment of time and effort when I already had very little time. I was either in class, rehearsals, eating, in sports, or studying from 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. every day. I had to learn 70 pages of hard-to-read rented manuscript, or Mr. Schneider threatened to not teach me anymore. I have no idea why I kept playing violin, except that I loved what music could be someday and wanted to be able to play well as an adult. There were other ways to get yelled at that were more fun, and I was to find many of them over the years. When I was a senior, I finally had a little self-confidence and said I would skip the musical. To give you an idea of the regimentation of that first year, in April, I stayed up until 10:05 p.m. in order to make my bed. However, I was discovered by Loose Jock, the housemaster from the other side of the dorm, and he put me on 7:30 study hours as punishment for not being in bed by 10. This meant I had to be in my room studying at 7:30 instead of 8. But the musical rehearsals were required appointments and were from 6:45 to 7:45, and I had to get from there back to the dorm. It's a little hard to imagine that all this was voluntary. This first year, I encountered computers. We had a time-sharing arrangement with Dartmouth's $20 million machine, with a room in the basement of the math building with several teletypes. These ran at a blazing 10 characters per second, which was the style at the time, and were equipped with paper tape readers and punchers. This tape could not be corrected, so a single character error would mean forced disposal of the entire tape and starting over. I learned BASIC and managed a few rudimentary tasks, but lost interest after a few months. The math department also purchased a Wang calculator the size of a small table for $10,000 that could do trig functions and square roots. Yawn. When they made one I could put in my pocket, my life would be entirely transformed. After finals and return home for the summer of 1970, I convinced Anton that Zeppelins were quite amazing and that we should build flying models. He made his own design and arranged with his neighbor Edward Weeks to use his barn for constructing both his and mine. Ed Weeks was retired from a long career as editor of the Atlantic Monthly. I also did major repairs to our small trimaran, which had fared badly during the winter. Anton's family spent some time each summer at Ogunquit, Maine, just south of Saco, where I camped at Furry Beach. He had a 10-foot O'Day Sprite sailing dinghy moored at West Beach just off Beverly Farms. I figured we could take both his boat and my trimaran, or team up on one boat, for the 100-mile sail. The prevailing winds are in that direction, so we figured it would take maybe 2 days, three at most. Unexpectedly, one evening, I got a call from Pigeon Cove, a little inlet at the tip of Cape Ann. That's maybe 15 miles toward Maine. Anton had taken off by himself without telling me, and after a day's hard slog had given up and pulled into the cove. He wanted me to help him sail back to Beverly Farms, as the wind was strong and in the wrong direction for continuing to Maine. "Okay," says I, and packed up for next day's adventure. We nearly surfed most of the way back, straight downwind, fantastic sail. The next day, Anton looked out at the mooring and saw the top of the mast sticking out of the water. Turns out the mast had been abrading the hull and had very nearly worn a hole in the bottom of the boat before he'd taken off from Maine. There was just enough fiberglass left for us to complete the previous day's sail. Overnight, the mast went through the bottom, filling the boat with water. Normally, this wouldn't have sunk the boat, but Anton had let the plugs in the watertight compartments get old and they fell out. Close call, that one. This inspired me to be vigilant on my maintenance and a touch wary of Anton's eye to safety. Life on the home front was more tense than ever. Dad had to quit his machinist job when his paychecks bounced for more than a month. He found work at Hood Yacht Systems, making rigging for top-notch racing sailboats, which I thought was wonderful. He wasn't so happy about it. My mother was prone to spells of anger, and she would say things like, "You can be replaced." Not easy to forget. Naturally, I spent as much time away from the family as possible. Second year, 1970 to 71. After a favorable draw in a lottery, I was able to move from my relatively austere dorm to the relative ease of Stearns Hall on Rabbit Pond. There, I had Jack Zucker as housemaster. He was a poet, English teacher, and a very cool guy. I had gotten used to Goober checking to see if my bed was completely free of wrinkles, and if not, he would dump the mattress and bedding on the floor. Nothing like that with Mr. Zucker. He was too out of shape to bother with that nonsense. And besides, he wasn't an alcoholic Protestant minister. Naturally, I was pleased that Andover now allowed Jews on the faculty. I got to know his family quite well. Instead of just first-year students, now I lived with the other three classes, which I much preferred. Things were far more relaxed now, and I started to enjoy school a lot more. One dorm resident in my class, but freshly arrived, was Peter Baldwin Fernberger. Through divorce and remarriage, he had two homes, both well-appointed, one in Weston near Boston and the other in Marblehead. While in junior high school in Weston, he had the misfortune of knowing fellow student Grover Norquist, later of right-wing political infamy. Peter says he was a jerk then, too. When in Marblehead, Pete sailed his 420 racing dinghy well enough to win an impressive trophy, and also sailed in his family's International One Design racing keelboat. He played a pretty mean trumpet and was easy to get along with. In time, we became good friends and remained so to this day. Not that I was an easy person to be friends with. After years of conflict with rich classmates, I had grown wary of people who could do what I could only read about and who had every possible advantage from being born in a prosperous family. I had to be convinced that someone would not treat me as an inferior if they were of a higher class, and sometimes that led to paranoia and not being able to form friendships that could have worked out just fine. With Pete, that was never a problem. He was always a very genuine person. While we're at it, I was also priggish, stubborn, dogmatic, obsessive, self-righteous, severely judgmental, quick to anger, impulsive, homophobic, lustful, inconsiderate, resentful, jealous, rebellious with or without cause, ungrateful, and self-centered. Practically presidential material. No wonder I wanted to conduct. Jack Zucker had me visit the school psychologist to rearrange my synapses. But talking about this and that was hardly going to do the kind of total renovation of my central nervous system that would be required. That would begin shortly. A classmate recently reminded me that I had entered my English class with Francis E. Belizia through the window when I was worried about being late. It was on the first floor, so no athletics were involved. He also remembered that I'd been expelled from that class for telling a terrible pun, something that had happened in other classes and schools. The teacher reported it to my housemaster somewhat differently. Quote, "He has been on several occasions a disruptive force in the group by attacking others or me verbally without apparent stimulus. One such outburst resulted in his ejection from the class." Close quote. Must have been quite a pun. This inspired the following poem, which I reproduce for your edification. Diderot, Cicero, Balzac, Belizia, gonna go to public school, 'cause it's easier. My parents read in the review written by Jack Zucker that, quote, "He is often more severe on the issue of student behavior and discipline than the most conservative faculty member." And this is strange indeed. It would be much more natural for him to identify, even slightly, with his own group. Close quote. Well, that was about to change. Some kids on my hall had a gallon jug of apple cider that they left near the radiator for about 2 months. The bottom third remained, and I asked what the heck that was. They invited me to chug it down and find out, which I did, sediment and all. It certainly bent my head out of shape, and for the next 3 days my intestines as well, but somehow I thought this alcohol stuff was worth another try someday. I put the Zeppelin in the basement of our dorm and tried to make some progress with it. However, someone busted it up, and the whole project was trashed after many months of work. Anton Zeppelin building continued until the following summer, when one of his friends sat on it. So all was lost. I would have to start building more sturdy objects. A more successful project was building my first kayak, teamed up with Peter. Outward Bound had its headquarters on the Andover campus, and they had a mold for making fiberglass whitewater kayaks. Several students were popping them out, and it looked very tempting indeed. The resulting boat was a lot of fun, but it was designed for quick turns in rocky rivers and was a challenge to use on the ocean. Nonetheless, I paddled it from my home in Danversport to Marblehead and back. There's a kind of intimacy one gets with the water in a kayak or similar very small boats that cannot be experienced in a larger boat. Kayaks are amphibious creatures like seals and can explore the meeting of the land with the water, which is the most interesting part of the ocean. Peace, love, dope. Well, at least dope. In the summer, when I wasn't at Ferry Beach, I hung out with Anton and Rose. On July 4th, we had a tradition of seeing fireworks set off at West Beach near his home. During the day, there was quite a party scene all along the beachfront. Anton had with him a rather substantial baggie of marijuana and a pipe, and said, "I should try some of this remarkable herb." It took quite a bit of toking to cut through my hardened awareness, and I thought it was having no effect. But after an hour or two, and the better part of the bag, whoosh, this here chemotherapy hit the spot. I needed something to break me out of my particularly unpleasant illusion, even if it was into yet another illusion for just a short time. This was a relatively harmless method. I smoked, sometimes a lot, sometimes only once in a couple of weeks, for the next 6 years. By that time, I understood the disadvantages and stopped for good. I could feel the effects for a couple of days. Several days after this first experience, I noticed that if I fully relaxed on my bed, I could get a sensation of floating right out of my body. This had happened many years ago in early childhood, and I didn't remember it until now. As a result, I started to meditate and chant. We had a paperback edition of the Bhagavad Gita, translated by Juan Mascaro, and I started to study it closely. Mom was taking hatha yoga classes, and I started attending and enjoying them. None of this was of any interest to me before smoking weed. My life had taken a dramatic turn, and there was no going back. It was time to start growing up. At one of Mom's hatha yoga classes, Isabel Hickey came to demonstrate a method of assisting people to remember past lives by a guided meditation. This was of great interest to me, and I wondered what would happen if I did the same with some of my friends. This would stick in the back of my mind until the following spring. Kathy was visiting home when Isabel was giving this class. She was living in Boston and acting with the Atma Company. Unfortunately, they had a Lebanese producer, and the cultural prejudices within the existing theater community were ultimately impossible to overcome. She appeared as Martha in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which I saw while on a field trip from Andover. She left some food behind, which I discovered one day while looking for some Worcestershire sauce to drink. My tastes were exotic then. There was some odd brown paste resembling dog droppings. I put some on my finger and tried it out. It tasted like extremely salty dirt. "What's this weird stuff?" I asked Dad. "Orientals put it in soup for stock," he replied. It was very strong miso. There was also some umeboshi salted plums that tasted like battery acid. We never used either of them, but the memory stuck. Also, I spotted a jar of brown rice on the shelf. I was intrigued, smelling it and running my hands through it. "What's this stuff?" I asked Mom. "It's brown rice, but it takes too long to cook," she replied, "so we never ate any." But I sprouted some in a pot, watching it grow with fascination. Turns out, Kathy was interested in macrobiotics. She tried eating brown rice and veggies, miso soup and seaweed in the recommended manner. Several days into a 10-day brown rice fast, she took a breath of marijuana smoke and saw nothing but blue. Looking down, she saw she was standing in water and had green leaves and a stalk for a body. She had transformed into a rice plant in the middle of a field. After coming back to her body, she said to her friend, "Let's go get a hamburger."